This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Remembering the past helps build a better future. Well, why then is it so difficult to recall those memories when the time is right? And is it possible to move forward without looking back? Well, those questions guide the characters in The Water Dancer. It's the new novel by prolific author Ta-Nehisi Coates. Coates rose to prominence for his nonfiction work, focusing on politics and race in America. But his latest book is a surrealist novel. It's about a slave born on a Virginia plantation who escapes bondage and then uses the power of memory to help others do the same. Ta-Nehisi Coates has written Between the World and Me. He's author of We Were 8 Years in Power, and he joins me now from NPR Studios in New York. Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Great for having you. Introduce us to your character. His name is Hiram. Talk about him a little bit and the setting that he inhabits in Virginia in The Water Dancer.
Sure. Hiram Walker is the son of an enslaved woman and the proprietor or master or planter, the head of a large plantation in Virginia called Lockless. He lost his mother at a very early age, and despite having a preternatural, almost photographic memory that allows him to recall almost anything, he cannot recall his mother. And that loss, that inability to recall, he believes, or he comes to believe, is somehow tied to his ambitions for freedom.
Hiram has both the blessing, if I can reduce it to that, and the curse of this photographic memory. It can be a big help, certainly a big help to readers in driving your narrative forward. And it can be a burden when there are things in life that you wish you could forget.
Exactly. And in this case, it really begins with his mother.
Well, you started researching and writing The Water Dancer 10 years ago, as I understand it. And during that time, a lot has happened, both in the life of America and I'd say in the life of Ta-Nehisi Coates. We observed 8 years of the first black presidency in this country, Barack Obama. The Black Lives Matter movement blossomed during that time. Your personal success and fame skyrocketed, and a lot of that did not sit well with you. How did the events of the last 10 years shape this book, your approach to it, do you think?
So I don't know that the politics did. I mean, maybe they did in some sort of subconscious way, or maybe they did in some sort of way that I'm not aware of. But in many ways, this book was my retreat from everything. Because it was the thing that, you know, even as I was engaged in some of these debates and arguments that felt separate from it, although obviously connected to it, but separate, it felt mine. It was really my my oasis in many ways. I love the process of writing books. I love the alone time. I love the feeling of doing something magical that only you know about, or maybe your editor, or maybe your spouse, if you're so fortunate. We live in a time where it's believed that every little thought and stray sort of imagining should be publicly consumed. And one of the real things that I really, really enjoyed about the past 10 years was really doing this in private. It was a place of great relief.
Was it therapeutic for you? Is that a fair term? You mentioned the term oasis. You know, people talk, not behind your back, but in front of your face, I guess, about the public debate. Ta-Nehisi Coates retreated from social media, where all those little individual thoughts have to be aired out publicly. That's people talking about you. But then I use the word retreat to do this book in private, large thoughts in private. Is that a form of personal therapy, that oasis, or just protection?
To some extent, I'm retreating from the word therapy because I think when people write as therapy or when books are only therapy, they tend to be bad books. I think therapy has a role, and I think books have a very, very different role. You know, even as I'm saying, you know, it was something that, you know, was created in private. It obviously will be consumed by public at some point. And so I don't know. I do think that I've come to think, you know, at 44 years old, that for writers, it's really, really important to have private space. I think, and maybe I shouldn't speak that large, you know, maybe I should just speak for myself. I just don't know how you're supposed to write when you're in constant conversation with people.
Hmm.
And I don't know how that happens.
And social media is such an onslaught, especially for a famous person, and frankly, you are one. I can see how you can't get cogent thoughts together if you're reacting constantly. It's just not conducive.
I mean, I couldn't. You know what I mean? Maybe there are people out there who can. You know what I mean? But it started to invade a really, really sacred place of mine. And I just, I think in many ways it spurred on or encouraged the worst aspects of me.
Mm. Well, let's dive back into the book just a little bit. Let you off the hook a little bit. Talk about
Thank
your
you.
Characters. Well, Harriet Tubman is a real historical figure. Americans mm-hmm. know that, or they should. Mm-hmm. She's a character in this book. She's called Moses in this story because of her ability to get enslaved people from the South to the North, almost like parting the sea in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. But why did you decide to go to Harriet Tubman?
'Cause I find Harriet Tubman fascinating, and I've found her fascinating all my life. I was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, Harriet Tubman State. My family's from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where Harriet Tubman's family is from. And as a kid, you know, growing up in the 1980s and the 90s, I mean, Harriet Tubman was like a superhero, you know, my first notions of a superhero. And so I just find her story, you know, her life to be utterly fascinating. And I was interested creatively in taking on the challenge of how you try to write about somebody like Harriet Tubman, but not have them as this sort of marble statue, you know what I mean, walking through your book, but you try to, you know, chisel them down into an actual, you know, imagined person. And so I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed writing her.
I think it's interesting you use the term superhero. There are superhero qualities in Hiram. Mm. Everybody knows, or maybe not everybody, but a lot of people know that you've written Black Panther. You've written Captain America, not just the water dancer. You describe Harriet Tubman even as a superhero. And this theme seems to be permeating a lot of your work. Do you think it's informed it in a really strong way?
I mean, probably, you know, it's like my earliest reading, you know, it was like comic books. I mean, maybe not my earliest, but certainly some of the most gripping, you know what I mean? When I think about being a child, you know, I think about Amazing Spider-Man, I think about X-Men, X-Factor, The Cloak and Dagger, you know, those are the books that I, you know, at an early point, and I'm talking like, you know, 9, 10, 11, you know, really got a hold of my imagination. And I don't know, like maybe you just don't, you know, progress from there, you know, maybe you just read everything through that lens.
And why not?
It's tough to answer.
And why not? I mean, you're not the first novelist. It was interesting to me because you're not the first novelist to apply superhero qualities to main characters in your book at times of great social unrest or trouble in their lives. Salman Rushdie's done the same thing. It's an excellent piece of plot driver. And Hiram, we won't delve in spoilers here, but Hiram certainly has some superhero characters. Well, we're going to take a short break. But before we do, we got this note from Scott in Michigan. He said, I can't get the sentence from Between the World and Me out of my head, where he lists several privileges enjoyed by most white people, but not most black people, and says that society has either failed in enforcing its good intentions or succeeded at something much darker. That's one listener who can't get Ta-Nehisi Coates' nonfiction out of his head. We're going to get Ta-Nehisi Coates' fiction into our heads. He's going to read a little bit from The Water Dancer after this short break. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. We'll have more in just a couple of minutes. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Bonnie, a Home Instead caregiver, works to enhance the lives of her aging clients and their families. Here, she shares her golden rule for care.
I would want her to be treated the way I'd want to be treated.
I come in and take care of her and do all of her personal care needs that she needs done and make sure she stays comfortable in her own home. We have a good time. We're best friends.
To learn more about Home Instead Senior Care's in-home care options, go to homeinstead.com.
All right, Professor McConaughey, are you ready for an Ask Me Another challenge?
All right, all right, all right.
Hey, everyone, it's Ophira Eisenberg. In this episode, we talk with actor Matthew McConaughey. Listen to NPR's Ask Me Another, the answer to life's funnier questions.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm speaking with Ta-Nehisi Coates about his work, a little bit about comic books, and of course about his new novel, The Water Dancer. Ta-Nehisi Coates, we've talked a little bit about it. Memories are what allow Hiram, your main character in The Water Dancer, to travel through space. He has a superhero quality. He can help enslaved people escape from bondage in the South to the North using some of these powers. Talk about why you made that choice, the importance of memory in your view, and how it helps drive the story here.
Yeah, let me just go back to, you know, the point about heroes and superheroes. I come up in an era of the post-civil rights movement where, you know, there were certain things that were apparent about American culture, and one of those was the extent to which, or the paucity of instances in which black people were allowed to occupy heroic roles in narrative. And as small as that might sound, I actually think it's quite important. I think, you know, the role of the hero in the culture is the exemplar often of qualities that the larger culture is supposed to emulate and is supposed to see. And when the hero is always white and almost always a white dude, you know, there's subtle messages that are sent out to the culture. And when you compound this over a period of literally centuries in America, that has certain effects. And so in my mind, and I don't know that I thought it out this clearly, but I wanted a hero who was black, and I wanted one who I would have wanted to read about when I was a child. I mean, taking this back to comic books again, I can remember, you know, reading X-Men as a kid. And the fact that there was, you know, like Storm, a black woman who at the time I was reading was like the leader of the group. I mean, this was like tremendous. I had never seen that in any other, you know, media form. And so I thought it was significant, you know, especially in this. There's so much literature, you know, since the period of emancipation over the past 150, 160 or so years in which white people have fashioned themselves as heroic during that period or during the period of the Civil War. And I just felt like it was our time.
Well, one thing we love to do on this show, and you're not the first, is we love to have authors read a little bit from their book mm-hmm. for us in your own voice. Mm-hmm. And we planned this a little bit. I know you have a passage prepared for us, so if you wouldn't mind turning to it, love to have you read for a minute or two from the perspective of Hiram, your main character, and reminding people that Lockless, as you mentioned, is the plantation in Virginia where he's enslaved. So, Ta-Nehisi Coates, if you're ready, go right ahead.
Sure, and this is just Hiram reflecting on his dad, and who, as I said, is master of the plantation, and his brother, his white brother, who lives up in the big house, as they say. And what of my father? What of the master of Lockless? I knew very early who he was, for my mother had made no secret of the fact, nor did he. From time to time, I would see him on horseback making his tour of the property, and when his eyes met mine, he would pause and tip his hat to me. I knew he had sold my mother, for Thena never ceased to remind me of the fact. But I was a boy, seeing in him what boys can't help but see in their fathers, a mold in which their own manhood might be cast. And more, I was just then beginning to understand the great valley separating the quality and the task, that the tasked, hunched low in the fields, carrying tobacco from hillock to hogshead, led back-breaking lives, and that the quality who lived in the house high above, the seat of Lockless, did not. And knowing this, it was natural that I looked to my father, for in him I saw an emblem of another life, one of splendor and regale. And I knew I had a brother up there, a boy who luxuriated while I labored, and I wondered what right he had to his life of idle pursuit, and what law deeded me to the task. I needed only some method to elevate my standing, to place me at some post where I might show my own quality.
So many heroes in comic books and in literature have this challenge. Absent parents, conflicts with parents, the need to impress a parent after being outcast, or even a sibling who's in the in while they're on the out. I noticed a parallel there, and I don't mean to bring every part of this story back to comic books, because it's certainly not all from there. But this reminded me of the struggle of many comic book heroes as well.
Yeah, well, I think the question that's worth asking is why are comic books often, why do comic books themselves have that, you know, as an origin? Mm. And I think part of this has to do with, I'll say two things. For me, actually, that part, like, it's very, very black, you know, the distance from Hiram's perspective is very, very black male and black boy, you know, to have that distance between yourself and your father. And then within our history, you know, having been enslaved in this country, you know, for 250 years, an essential part of that experience was the destruction of family, was the parting of family, was, you know, the selling off of mothers and fathers. And a second part of that was the epic of rape. I mean, rape on a mass level. It's not a mistake that if you go to an African-American family reunion, you can see people of all skin tones. And that's marked us in a particular way. And in that passage, Hiram's a young boy trying to grapple with that. Now, the other thing, just getting back to your question, is a lot of this, weirdly enough, actually echoes very, very classical, you know, notes in storytelling, as you just mentioned, you know, the fracturing of family, the thing between, you know, two brothers. But I don't know if it's because of the place that classical storytelling often comes from, but a lot of that is already embedded in African American history. What I'm trying to say is, it's not like I had to take an outside lens,
right,
and then apply it to being black. It is within the history and the culture of black folks themselves.
Well, throughout the book, Hiram works to remember more about his mother, who seems to be the one thing he can't remember clearly. Mm-hmm. As we mentioned at the top, he has this almost supernatural memory, this blessing and this curse. But as he remembers his mother, his abilities become stronger and stronger. I call it his superpower. What do you... Did this come from a place of the history of your own family? I mean, clearly it did. I wonder how much you know about the history of your own family going back from before your parents.
Well, I know quite a bit now. I was on Finding Your Roots by Henry Louis Gates.
That'll do it.
Yeah, I know a lot. I don't know. You know, unlike Hiram, I had both of my parents were in the house, and I remember them completely and totally. I think there's something... maybe a little more metaphorical in there, you know, because it's not just that he can't remember his mother, it's that his mother was taken from him in such a way that perhaps to remember would cause great agony and great pain. And yet at the same time, he can't really fully emancipate himself if he does not remember. And I think that is probably true to some extent of a lot of people. One might even say it's true of a society, you know, true of a country, a state, you know, but there's, I think, a larger thing that can be read into that.
And let's take a step away from the book into the world of politics, because there is a larger thing to read into that. One of the big messages behind the push for reparations is that you can't heal the past unless you can remember it clearly and remember it accurately. You are famous now. You wrote in 2014 in The Atlantic, The Case for Reparations, and it re-energized this long debate. Let's just take a moment to reprise your argument, The Case for Reparations, in 2019, and what they should look like, because this has ascended to the presidential campaign. It's ascended to Capitol Hill, where you testified. So remind us, maybe in just a minute, the case for reparations and why it matters to you now.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. I mean, African Americans labored, you know, without pay on these shores for 250 years. After the period of emancipation, they were subject to a century-long terrorist campaign that deprived them of their lives, deprived them of their votes, deprived them of countless property, destroyed families. and allowed for, you know, basically throughout the southern states, all white governments. This pillage, this plunder, marks society at every level. It marks to this very day our university system. Practically almost all of your Ivy League schools have roots in slavery. Brown University, founded by the Brown brothers, slave traders. Harvard University, it's a law school originally underwritten by a man by the name of Isaac Royal, who was, you know, a slaveholder, big plantation holder in the West Indies. Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., saved from bankruptcy by the sale of black people, by the destruction of black families, blood on their hands. And the thing that I always remind people is it's not as if after that period of emancipation, which, you know, as critics often point was, you know, oh, it was a long, long time ago. It's not as if, you know, this country, you know, then decided to welcome black people into its society with open arms. As I, you know, mentioned earlier, what followed was Jim Crow. And so when we look at the state of black people, when we look at the fact that black people occupy today the bottom rung in almost every socioeconomic category, the reasons for that are not mysterious. The fundamental thread that runs through the relationship between black people and white people in this country is one of theft. And so the expectation that, you know, some, you know, almost 400 years of this, or if we're being, you know, conservative, 350 years of this, would be made up for by, you know, modest, you know, vague affirmative action policies is ludicrous. What needs to happen is, you know, there needs to be some reapportionment of resources, at least, you know, some attempt to repay what was stolen, what was taken, what was pillaged, and what was plundered.
Well, the presidential candidates in the Democratic primary, many of them have taken a position on reparations. House Democrats have been introducing bills. Some of them have gone toward the floor on reparations. Here's Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey. He's a candidate in the 2020 primary in June, talking about reparations at a hearing where you were as well.
I feel a sense of anger where we are in the United States of America, where we have not had direct conversations all about a lot of the root causes of the inequities and the pain and the hurt manifested in economic disparities, manifested in health disparities, manifested in a criminal justice system that is indeed a form of new Jim Crow.
There is the danger here, you know, that in an early Democratic primary, in a very progressive primary where candidates have talked in a meaningful way about reparations, maybe for the first time, people have warned, that's great. And as soon as they reach the point where they have to talk to white people in the suburbs who don't like that idea, the appearance of reparations on the lips of Democratic candidates will probably go away.
If this were applied to every policy which this country now takes credit for, we would be in big, big trouble. People pretend as though emancipation was a popular idea. They pretend as though until relatively recently, marriage equality was a popular idea. They pretend as though Brown v. Board was a popular decision, integration a popular idea. What thing has ever been done on behalf or to advance the interests of African Americans and the larger interests of the country that was popular? I mean, what do you say? So, you know, do you want to go say, you know, to Martin Luther King that he shouldn't have, you know, marched and pushed for integration because it wasn't popular, that he shouldn't have pushed Johnson because Johnson would have to, you know, might face the possibility and indeed did lose the South? I don't understand people who in one breath honor the courage of Lincoln, of King, of Douglas, and then urge their politicians towards cowardice. You know, it's one or the other. You know, have the courage, you know, of your convictions. Have the courage of your words. You know, if you believe in heroism then, believe in the heroism now.
It's very interesting for political analysts everywhere, and I count myself among them as somebody who's covered politics for a very long time. It's very easy to forget how unpopular key policies that we take for granted today, like Brown v. Board, really were at the time. Not only that they were introduced, but they were being fought for, and that political expediency in a general election campaign is not always the quick answer we think it is. More with Ta-Nehisi Coates on the role of nonfiction and fiction just after this. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
Hey, Asma, I think it's time for a big change.
All right, what does that mean?
I think it's time to make the NPR Politics Podcast a daily podcast.
Well, we do have more than ample news. You and I are on the campaign trail, it seems like, nonstop.
And now there's an impeachment inquiry into President Trump.
So starting this week, the NPR Politics Podcast will be in your feed every weekday to keep you up to date ahead of the 2020 election.
So subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, the NPR Politics Podcast, now 5 days a week.
Welcome back to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Ta-Nehisi, yesterday on this very program, we had a conversation about plantation tourism and how the industry remembers or does not remember its violent history of slavery. Now, this is Derek Alderman. He's a professor at the University of Tennessee. He runs an organization called Tourism Reset. Listen.
If we're really going to engage in these very deep, more meaningful discussions of slavery, there is a certain level of responsibility that sites have, plantation museums have, for creating spaces in which there can be a larger discussion, a debriefing, a coming to terms with those feelings and those memories and those meanings.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, what's your take on this? How do you think plantations that exist today as tourist attractions, sort of living museums of the antebellum or Civil War South, should use their platforms to tell the history of violent bondage to their visitors?
I think they should tell the history of violent bondage, which is what they really do. One of the things that happened at the end of the Civil War is the war of memory and culture and heritage was really, really won by the enslavers, such that, you know, people want to go to plantations today, you know, which really are, you know, forced labor camps, because that's what they were. They want to go to sites of forced labor camps and, you know, sip mint juleps and, you know, hear about, you know, plants and see, you know, these big billowing dresses and all of this stuff. It's deeply, deeply dishonorable. And I don't mean to personalize it, because, you know, people come up with the history that they come up with. You know, you can't expect them to be, you know, much more than that. But these sites that claim to give education, I think, could do a lot better at giving some true education as to what actually happened there. You know, I think, you know, I'm encouraged by, you know, certain things. I'm encouraged by the Whitney Plantation down in just outside of New Orleans, which has done this great job of showing off the plantation from the perspective of the enslavers. I'm encouraged by what's going on at Monticello right now, where if you get the tour at Monticello, you will get, you know, enslavement. You will not escape it. There's no way of not getting it. And so I think folks are moving in the right direction. I'd just like to see more.
Let's get back into Ta-Nehisi Coates as a writer and what he means to his audience, because we got this voicemail from Greg, who's in Nashville.
I'm a big fan of Ta-Nehisi Coates. I read Between the World and Me, and I'm reading The Water Dancer now. I enjoy his books because I like the way he tells his stories. It reminds me of Toni Morrison.
Well, Greg, thanks for that call. And speaking of the late Toni Morrison, she reportedly read a copy of The Water Dancer and wrote a letter to your editor. And I'm quoting now, "I have been wondering who might fill the intellectual void that plagued me after James Baldwin died. Clearly, it's Ta-Nehisi Coates." Ta-Nehisi, I don't know if the comparison overwhelms you or embarrasses you or you think it's apt. What do you think?
I think it's hard to imagine myself on this radio program without Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. I think you have to understand like Toni's legacy. It's actually the writing is obviously tremendous, Nobel laureate level, but it's actually bigger than that, if that's at all possible. When I was a kid, there was this book that my dad used to have, you know, around the house, and it was called The Black Book, and I was sort of obsessed with this book, and I would flip through the book. You know, my dad had a lot of books around the house. And that book was edited and put out by Toni Morrison. And I had never, you know, read Beloved or anything like that at that point. I had never read, you know, The Bluest Eye or anything like that. She had a tremendous career as an editor at Random House, became an incredible, you know, obviously author in her own right. Her ability to just craft, you know, sentences is something that, that I envy, you know. But I bring up that earlier point about being an editor because that letter, that quote that she sent to my editor did so much for Between the World and Me. And what that means is it's a magnificent thing to be a great writer, but very, very few people are both great writers and at the same time are able to, you know, birth their own, you know, other authors and their own, you know, literature that comes out of that. And so she was, you know, at once, you know, a singular figure, but also the font, you know, for so many other, you know, writers and books that passed her way or came through her editing hands.
Well, speaking of authors, Ta-Nehisi Coates, we had Colson Whitehead on this program just a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I spoke to him about his new novel, Nickel Boys, and we talked about the ability of the novel to impact society, maybe even impact politics. Nickel Boys, of course, about the mistreatment of black youth in essentially juvenile hall prisons, boarding schools in Florida, in the South. You and I have talked about nonfiction in a book like Between the World and Me or The Case for Reparations impacting the debate. But here's what Colson Whitehead had to say about the ability of fiction to impact the debate.
I don't think novels have that centrality in the culture where we can change institutions. I had a reading last week and I was sort of talking with the audience. When's the last time a novel had that sort of society-altering impact? And that was Uncle Tom's Cabin. Somebody finally came up with an answer. It was a novel, but also a political tract intended to inform the North about the true face of slavery in the South. I don't think that the people who need to read a book like this, we'll read a book like this. I think they're busy devising other ways to keep in power and abuse the innocent and the powerless.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, it's a decidedly pessimistic view from novelist Colson Whitehead. The people who need to read this book aren't going to read it, and the people who do read it probably didn't need to read it. That's my shorthand of what he had to say. I wonder if you agree.
Oh, man, it troubles me to actually have to disagree with the incredible Colson Whitehead. The Intuitionist was like one of the first books that I read that got me to the notion of wanting to actually try something like this. I mean, I can't stress how big of an impact that book had on me. And so it troubles me to, A, have to disagree with Colson, you know what I mean, who's brilliant, but also to have to play the role of the optimist here. I think he's wrong. I think he's quite clearly wrong. You don't have to go back to Uncle Tom's Cabin to find, you know, a novel that had, I mean, The Klansman by Thomas Dixon had tremendous, tremendous impact. The Klansman, which went on to become Birth of a Nation, mm-hmm. which literally reignited the second coming of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. That started with a book.
I thought about The Jungle, too.
The Jungle's another one. Gone with the Wind. I mean, good Lord, we just finished talking about plantation tours. I mean, Gone with the Wind. You know, I don't know if people imagine themselves, you know, on plantation tours the way they do without Gone with the Wind. And had I been prepared for this question, I probably could keep going beyond that. You know, but I think the biggest thing, I think what Colson is at is on to something. And what he's actually on to is that novels don't impact in the direct way. In other words, mm-hmm. they don't, you know, they may not always spur people to political act, like make somebody want to go on a march or make somebody, you know, want to pass a bill. That's not how it happens. But the novel and narrative is extremely, extremely powerful. It's not always directly powerful. You can't see it in the moment, but the long-term impact of books should not be underestimated. And I say that, if I may be so rude, of Colson's own work.
Indeed.
Because I don't know that The Water Dancer would exist in and of itself, you know, without the Intuitionist,
well,
actually.
And I'm glad that the two of you disagree over that, because it gives us more time to talk about it, and it gives us more more reason to ponder that question along with the audience. Ta-Nehisi Coates, he's author of Between the World and Me. He's author of We Were 8 Years in Power, and he's author of the novel The Water Dancer. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thank you so much for being with me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Avery Kleiman and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you, as always, from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. This is 1A.